We've been to all four corners of Britain in our quest to interview the great and good of entertainment. Comics, actors, writers, politicians, singers, dancers and choreographers. It doesn't matter who they are. They've all given me their own take on the world they live in and have, in their own way, helped to define what makes Britain great. So join me and my assistants as we get another insight into the marvellous and enigmatic world of showbiz here on Beyond the Title.
One of the defining voices in sports presentation, writer and broadcaster John Inverdale has been presiding over some of our greatest sporting moments for over three decades. Making his BBC radio debut in 1985 as a newsreader for Sport on 2 before joining the presenting team at Sky, where he teamed up with future BBC stalwart Alan Hansen for the now infamous Goals on Sunday and took football punditry into a new dimension. A move to BBC Radio 5 in 1994 resulted in Inverdale's laid-back commentary on everything from Wimbledon to the FIFA World Cup final. In 2012, as freelance, he represented ITV's coverage of Roland Garros before delivering an emotional presentation of the sailing trials at the London Olympics. I caught up with one of Britain's leading broadcasters to talk sport, presenting, and his recollections on an unparalleled career in broadcasting. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. John Inverdale.
We'll get on to the major highlights of your career in a moment, but firstly, I'd be interested to know what the major changes in British sport have been and over your years as a broadcaster.
Great, that is a really big question to start off with. The biggest changes. Well, I think the obvious thing to say is the advent of cable satellite television. You know, when I started, literally, there was the BBC and there was ITV, and that was it. I mean, that makes it sound like, you know, well, and it makes it sound almost like the black and white world. It wasn't quite that. We had got colour television when I started. But, you know, when Sky came in, and British Satellite Broadcasting, as they were called, in 1989, and I actually started with BSB, it was just transformational. I mean, it really, really was. And people always say this, that, you know, and it's a suitable time to, so that's, you can probably see my dog just leaving the room there behind. he gets very bored when I start talking. But, you know, we're doing this interview in May, the weekend after the cup final. And people always say this, but, you know, when I started, there was only one live game of football on television every year, and that was the FA Cup final. That's why it was such a big deal. You know, I watched the Rangers final last night. You know, if you can watch, I could watch a Premier League game tonight. I could watch a game from all over the world at any time of the day almost. That's the single biggest change. And it's utterly transformational. But what, of course, it does do is it divides audiences. Because in days gone by, when there was only one thing to watch from a sporting perspective, everybody watched it. Now, because you can watch anything whenever you want to watch it, involved in whatever way you want it to be watched, it actually means that the numbers get much, much smaller. So, you know, even though media rights are an unbelievably important, the single most important thing in funding sports, sometimes you're broadcasting to very, very few people. So, you know, there are good and there's good and there's bad, but the good massively outweighs the bad. I mean, the idea, you know, listen, when I started, you know, an Ashes test series in Australia, you know, it was on the radio, well, that was it. You barely saw a picture, a Lions tour overseas, you never saw it. So that's massive progress. It really is.
Yeah. So actually the next question is talking about the beginning of your career in radio for BBC Radio 2. Josh believes in 1985. What are the significant hurdles when you attempt to put live sport on a medium without pictures?
Hurdles? Well, I'd look at it the other way, you see. I'd look at it as the opportunities rather than the hurdles. Because I think the great thing about broadcasting, there are two things that matter in broadcasting, voice and vocabulary. And if you've got both those, or you have a percentage of both of those, you can do something with them. And I think that, you know, the thing that has always amazed me is, for instance, how golf works on the radio, because you wouldn't think it would do, really. Mm. But actually, it almost works better on the radio than any other sport, providing you've got the right people describing it. Because if you're sitting watching golf on television, by the very nature of how golf is covered on television, you see the player, you see the swing, you see the ball in the air, you see where it lands. And the coverage can be quite one-dimensional in a way. Mm. Whereas on radio, you can talk about the player, you can talk about the swing, you can talk about the ball, you can talk about where it lands, but you can also talk about people that you see, about birds that you can see, about insects that you can see, about boats out at sea, which the camera actually hasn't focused on at that particular moment. So you can create a much more holistic and bring, in effect, it's a strange kind of thing. You can actually bring the event much closer to the person who's listening than television can, which may sound strange, but I actually do think that in some instances, you know, that is actually true. But obviously, it's all about the messenger. You've got to have the right people who are able to describe it for you. But once, if you have got them, then I think, you know, events like golf, and also, you know, like state occasions, you know, trooping the colour and things like that. If you've got the right people with the right words and the right ability to actually just see what they're seeing and almost tell it. I was always told that you had to broadcast to your mum if you were broadcasting, because your mum might not be remotely interested in golf, shall we say. But if you could broadcast to your mum and make her interested, then everybody would be interested. And that's not being disparaging or anything. It's just, I think it's a very sensible rule of thumb about how to try and get people to be engaged in what you're doing.
Yeah. Something that I didn't know about your career was that you joined the broadcasting team at Sky Sports during its infancy stage. In today's multi-channel landscape, we take wall-to-wall live football for granted. But what was that like to be part of something that was about to revolutionise how we would consume live sport?
It was very, very exciting and quite scary. I did all the Scottish football on British satellite broadcasting when it started. Every week, Tuesday, Wednesday nights, we'd be at St Mirren or Motherwell or wherever it might be. And the thing that amazed me most was I actually wasn't sure that anybody was watching, because you couldn't be, because it was just utterly embryonic. And I do remember a game, I think it actually was at St Mirren, where we walked to the ground at Love Street, where St Mirren played. And we walked to the ground, and I remember the very first time I saw a satellite dish on the side of a house. And I thought, wow, that's us. There is somebody out there after all. But the great thing about it was, in those days, you know, as we were starting out, and I'd never done television at that stage, was, and I'm absolutely sure, I don't have a single recording of any of those programmes anywhere, which is, I regret now. But if one did exist somewhere, I'm sure I was absolutely dreadful. But because the audience was nil, it meant you could learn on the job. Which I don't think you should be allowed to, really. I really think you ought to serve your apprenticeship elsewhere and work your way through the groups. You don't suddenly play for Manchester United. You know, you should be playing. You should have a few games at Rochdale before you do that. But I mean, we went straight in doing it, and you know, and some of the pundits that we had, somebody like Graham Souness from the Word Go, you know, has been a brilliant pundit for 35 years now. But I'm sure he carried me through those early days. But that's my abiding memory of those early days, wondering if there was anybody there. And then, as the year, 18 months or so went by, first 2 years, suddenly you noticed satellite dishes cropping up all over the place. So you realised that it was a slow burner, but bit by bit by bit, you know, exponentially, it got bigger.
Yeah. And then in 94, you moved to Radio 5, where you become a sport and commentator on everything from the World Cup to Wimbledon. In your opinion, how important is 5 Live in upholding the BBC's vision for live sport to air for free? And what's easier, presenting or commentating?
Lots of questions in there. Well, I mean, obviously Talk Sport didn't exist in those days, so you had a monopoly. I think one of the great things about, in just in general terms, I think having sport available to as many people as possible in whatever formats as possible is good for sport, you know, full stop. But obviously, you know, there are these days with the financial requirements to operate sports, it does mean that in a television term, obviously, that sometimes free-to-air events go to satellite or subscription because that pays the bills. We haven't quite got to that stage yet on radio. Now, whether we did, I think it would be very interesting. You know, if at some point another radio station came along that bought the rights to events, but you then had to pay to listen to that radio station, I don't understand how technically that could work or operate. But if, you know, how you would block the signal on a digital radio set station, I don't quite know how you do that. But if that circumstance came to pass, do I think that would be a good thing? I don't think it would, actually. I think the fact that if there's anything happening anywhere, by and large, and you're driving or you're on the train or you're just, you know, on the beach or wherever you are, and you've got your radio or your phone and it's there, I think that's actually quite important that it doesn't cost you any money. I really do. In terms of presenting and commentating, it depends. It really does. Commentating requires you to be very on your toes, obviously, because it's all happening in front of you. But in a funny kind of way, that's easier because it's happening in front of you. So all you've got to do, I don't mean that in a disparaging sense, but all you've got to do is describe what's happening in front of you. Mm-hmm. When you're presenting, invariably, when you're presenting, nothing's actually happening. So yeah. Therefore, you've got to be more inventive, if you like, in what you say, because you've got actually nothing to act as the hook about what, which is, you know, driving what you're saying.
Yeah. Joining the BBC at a time when so many of the pioneers of sports presentation were still very much active must have been an invaluable schooling. How significant were people like David Coleman, Des Lynam, and David Vine in establishing a successful formula for sports broadcasting, which your generation could build upon and refine to what it is today?
Massively. And I always remember being in a hotel with David Coleman in Budapest in 1998 at the European Athletics Championships. And he summoned me. I'd only ever really had two or three conversations with him. In a sort of cursory kind of way. And the athletics had finished and we'd gone back to the hotel bar. And it was almost like he summoned me over literally beckoned me with his finger. And I went and sat down. It was almost like I was being, you know, going to the feet of the king of broadcasting. Because, I mean, for me, and again, this may be, your memory maybe distorts things, but David Coleman's performance at the Munich Olympics in 72, when, you know, the operation was much smaller than it is nowadays and the terrorist attack happened and he had to hold the whole thing together for like days on end. That was one of those things that made me want to do what I ended up doing. But anyway, he summoned me over and he sat down and he said, I've heard a lot of you. I said, oh, thank you, David, you know. And he just said, remember the value of silence. And I said, yeah. And he said, it's possible to talk too much. It's always possible to talk too much. Let the pictures speak for themselves. And sometimes even on radio, let the sounds speak for themselves. And again, an invaluable piece of advice. You know, sometimes just, you know, anybody can say, just listen to this noise. Isn't it amazing? I mean, anybody can say that. Mm-hmm. But the clever people actually don't say anything. I let the noise speak for itself.
Yeah. You've also been synonymous with the coverage of boxing, particularly when it was on the BBC. In your opinion, how has the commercialisation of the sport compromised its legacy?
Now, that is a good question. And funnily enough, I'm actually having dinner with Barry Hearn next week, when it would be an interesting conversation to have with him.
Yeah.
I do think for all the hoopla about Tyson Fury and Anthony Joshua to a lesser extent, perhaps, I do think the fact that boxing, which, I mean, I would just, let me go back on that. I would say after football, boxing is probably the second biggest sport in this country in terms of a sport where you have an event that more people will watch it than any other sport. Going back to the days of Nigel Benn and everybody else, you know, 15, 20 million audiences, not uncommon for Saturday night fights 30 odd years ago. Boxing is a major sport when it's presented to the public en masse. The danger, and I understand the financial issues as well, but the danger when it becomes exclusive to Box Nation or wherever it might be, is that while the stars of boxing may be stars within their own firmament, they don't cross over. And so whereas the names of McGuigan and Minter and Ben and Watson are there for all to see forever, the world champions that Britain has at the moment, I think you could go into an awful lot of sport-centric bars or sport or environments and say, tell me about whoever it might be. And they'd say, who are they? And I think, you know, once you've gone from Fury, Joshua, probably Katie Taylor, I think you're struggling to put big boxing names out in the general sporting landscape at the moment. Now, and then it comes down to a straightforward argument. If I'm a boxer and I can get X as my purse fighting on Channel 4, but I can get 3X as my purse fighting on a subscription channel, which probably means that my outside ring earnings are going to be less, what do I do? And the answer probably is I go for the latter.
Yeah. What do you think about the situation that's happening? You said you're meeting with Barry Hearn next week. What do you think about the situation with DAZN, where Eddie Hearn's attempting to bring sort of live boxing back every week? It's still a subscription service, but it's more of a accessible subscription service, I suppose, where...
Well, it's only accessible. Things are only accessible if people know they're there.
Yeah.
I mean, the interesting thing about the French Open tennis next week, which I've done for years, but I'm not doing this year because ITV has not got the contract anymore. The number of people at my tennis club who were saying to me, where do we watch it? How do we watch it? You've got to get the message. You people have somehow got to know where this is, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Because if you don't know where it is, you don't know where it is. I know that sounds a bit ridiculous, but the key thing is in the message. You know, we're in a communication industry. You know, the whole of our industry is a communication industry. That's going with that, goes without saying. But if you don't communicate well, if your PR is not very good, if the message telling is not very good, it doesn't matter how good your coverage is, nobody knows it's there. And I think, you know, if there was a boxing, if 10 o'clock, I don't know, 10 o'clock, 8 o'clock on a Tuesday evening, every Tuesday evening, big boxing. If you get that into people's minds, if they're interested in boxing, then yeah, why, you know, maybe that is, a very shrewd way of going forward. But I do think it's interesting that, going back to something I said half an hour ago or whatever it was, you know, the diminution or the divergence of the whole industry means that things end up becoming more and more niche because you end up preaching to the converted. And anybody can do that. Anybody can. If I am an absolute nut on table tennis, and table tennis television have big major championships at 10 o'clock on a Friday morning every week from all around the world, I will subscribe to Table Tennis TV to watch that. All you've got to tell me as a member of a table tennis club is that it's on and I'll watch it. But that doesn't grow your sport. That keeps your sport within the confines of that sport. The trick is how do you go from being that size to that size, to that size, to that size, and make it bigger. That's the trick. And that, of course, you talk about Eddie Hearn, that, of course, is what Barry Hearn did with snooker and did with darts as well. You take it from its fundamental base, just grow it.
Josh, it's a bit like what NBC are doing in America with the Premier League. And I think it was Gary Neville said that when he's in America, it's easier for him to watch Premier League games in America than it is in England, because you've got NBC, you can watch every Premier League game and you can pick from all of the 3 o'clock kickoffs.
Yes, but of course you can't do that here, and you shouldn't do that here, because you still want people in the ground. And and you know, one of the great things, I mean, you have to go back, well, the pre-Sky Sports days, and you watch some highlights of first division matches, you know, and the grounds are half empty. You know, I could be sitting at my desk here at 11 o'clock in the morning, and I could say, you know, Brighton are playing Spurs this afternoon. Should we go? Yeah, all right then. Walk along and go.
Yeah.
Can you imagine doing that now? You mean it doesn't, you know, so you've got, but that's because, you know, there was no football on in those days, going back to what I was saying earlier. You can't, if every single match at 3 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon was available to be watched in its entirety, then you're starting to erode the experience through the screen, because nothing makes an event look as good as a full house, as a lot of people being there. The moment you start seeing on television swathes of empty seats, you think, well, if people can't be bothered to go and watch this, why should I watch it? And that's why you can't do that in this country, and nor I think should you be able to.
Hmm. So another sport now. An actual move to television eventually resulted in you becoming the main anchor for BBC's coverage of the Six Nations. What are the main challenges of presenting high-profile events such as these?
Well, one of the main challenges is being impartial. Yeah. Which people will, no matter how much you can protest about your impartiality, people will always say you're biased one way or t'other, because they come at it with their own bias in the first place. So the hardest thing as well, I think, is in terms of rugby, the hardest thing is, and this all these conversations are interlinked. You know, rugby is not a major sport. It's a big sport, but it's not a major sport. But it's a big sport with major events. So the Six Nations, suddenly, you know, on a regular week on BT, if they've got an audience of 100,000, 200,000 watching those matches, suddenly you go to a Six Nations match where there's 9 or 10 million people watching. So the biggest challenge, because it's stating the obvious here, is that the overwhelming majority of people who are watching that match certainly have never played the game, and most of them probably don't really understand the nuances of it, but they're watching because it's an event. It's what people talk about. They go to the pub to share a common experience. So the biggest challenge is to try, without alienating and annoying the rugby aficionado, the biggest challenge is to talk in terms and use words that are engaging, interesting. So people who are sitting at home going, it's England against Wales, I'm interested in this because it's England against Wales, to make them understand it, why it's exciting, why it matters, why that incident was of significance, what happened there, and not get bogged down in jargon, which a lot of sports can get completely obsessed by. And to try and always, going back to what I was saying earlier, you know, my dad was, rugby was his life, but, you know, and my mum went along to, you know, to watch games with him, but she would never really, you know, she'd never say she enjoyed the game, but she never said she understood the game. Always trying to broadcast to your mum, you know, why, you know, is she going to stay and watch the whole game? Yeah. Or, and at half time, is she going to go off and do something else, or is she going to stay and listen to the chat? That's always the, you know, the premise almost.
Yeah, we've got a question now, which is a bit of a different one. It was actually one that was suggested to ask you. Is it true that Jonathan Davis once roughed you up on air? No. Okay.
I don't know. No, I don't know where on earth that came from. Where did that come from?
I thought it was a bit random. It's basically, someone that follows the podcast used to work in broadcasting. I think they used to do production or something. And there was a rumor that Jonathan Davis used to go around roughing people up.
So, yeah. Well, if he did go around roughing people up, he must have missed me on the way.
That's yeah. You escaped.
I escaped. That's the headline. I escaped Jonathan Davis.
Yeah. Don't really know what the roughing up is referring to, but
no, I'm thinking of some sort of physical contact.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe he crash tackled me in a bar one night. Yeah, right? Maybe. If he did, I've got no recollection of it. Put it that way.
So, London 2012 was a very special occasion for almost everyone living in Britain. One of the defining moments of the whole event was your reaction to Mark Hunter and Zach Purch's silver medal performance. As a spectator, what did you find so moving about that? And as a broadcaster, how did it feel to somewhat lose your composure on live TV?
Well, of course, it's interesting that these days people losing their composure on television is almost mandatory. But actually, if you go back 10 years ago, it was very unusual because there was still that kind of not quite stiff upper lip, but it just wasn't really part of the broadcaster's makeup. I think from a spectator, well, I mean, it's a very simple answer, really. These guys who you'd kind of followed them for 8 years, actually, because they'd won in Beijing, but you'd followed them for 8 years. You knew that every morning at crack of dawn, they were out on the water and their training program was such that they did 500, 1,000, 1,500, 1,800, 200 metres to go, put the hammer down, win. That's how they lived for 7 years, basically, almost being, unbeatable. And that's how the engine worked. It was like, a finely oiled car, like a machine. And then on the day, perhaps the single most important day of their lives as sports people, they got 500, 1,000, 1,500, 200 to go, put the hammer down, and the clutch stuck, or whatever analogy you want to use. It just, for whatever reason, instead of going like that, it was like they had the handbrake on.
Yeah.
And they couldn't believe it. Because they couldn't rationalize it. They couldn't work out how that had happened. And just to see a sense of desolation and actually shock, non-understanding of how something that they'd done hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, but at the key moment when it had to happen, it didn't happen. So to see that sense of loss, it was almost a kind of bereavement in their eyes. You've got to be quite steely, I think, to not emotionally engage in that. And I could just see the shock on their face. And they were such great guys. They've been such good people to work with for such a long period. I was so disappointed for them. And it was, I couldn't wait to throw to the next race.
Yeah, I suppose that must be quite a difficult thing to manage when you're doing broadcasting for things like the Olympics and stuff, because with football and rugby and things like that, I suppose there's always that thing of there's always next week or there's always next year. But with something like the Olympics, like you say, some of these athletes go through, 8 year programs for one race. And, for some people, it can be all over after that. And
yes,
from your point of view, past being a spectator as a broadcaster, that must be quite a difficult thing to actually manage. When you get thrown over to them,
Well, I mean, in that situation, I mean, you've pinpointed it exactly. At that moment, I'm looking at them. I'm not saying this, but I'm looking at them and I'm thinking, I mean, they apologize for winning a silver medal. You know, you'll say, well, steady on. You know, most people would give their own teeth to have a set silver medal.
Yeah.
But you're looking at them thinking, do you really want to, with all due respect, you know, in the context of rowing, world championships, European championships, all well and good, but in the broader scheme of things, it's Olympics or bust. Do you really want to spend the next four years of your life going through this again and again and again and again, knowing also there is the possibility in 4 years' time that 200 metres from the end, when you put the hammer down, the clutch might stick again and you might be in this position again, and that's another 4 years of your life gone. I know this is painting this rather sort of in a gloomy scenario, but I was thinking, I was thinking that, looking at them while talking to them, at their moment of, you know, desolation almost. So there are lots of, and the other thing as well is that, you know, in those moments there are certain things you should say, and certain things you shouldn't. And as the years and over the years, you know, you do say some pretty stupid things, but hopefully as the years go by, the stupid things get fewer. Fewer and further between.
Yeah.
Only walk past me every day.
Josh said he watched it back the other day, and you actually said to them, you know, I know this is probably the last thing that you want to do right now, but, you know, kind of need to talk to you about it. That must be difficult. You know, you see it sometimes at the athletics. I think recently, I think it was.
Well, it's about trust. I tell you what it is. It's about trust. It's also, that's one of the key things about knowing people. If you, you know, in that kind of situation, if you are just random individual with microphone,
yeah,
then it's hard. But if you know the people and you can look them in the eye, you can look at them. I mean, that's one of the key things as well. You know, don't look at your notes. Just don't look at your notes. If you need notes, you shouldn't be doing the job.
Yeah.
But look them in the eye and say, in a way, without saying it, you're saying, I understand. I mean, I don't understand, but I do understand.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't been there, but I understand the trauma that you're going through. I'm not going to throw you under a bus. I have to ask you these questions. You know, I have to ask you these questions. I won't push you too far. I'll do it in as considerate a way as I possibly can, given the circumstances. Mm-hmm. And you're doing that. And what it's just taken me 25 seconds to enunciate to you, you've actually communicated that to them in less than a second of eye contact, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, that it's an extraordinary way that human beings communicate with each other. And, you know, so you look in those situations, you look at, in that instance, Zach and Mark, you look at them, they look at you, they're almost looking at you going, help. And I'm looking at them going, we're going to have a chat, but it will be all right. And honestly, you know, believe you me, everybody who watches this interview will be on your side. Nobody's going to criticize you. Nobody's feeling bad about you. But all that I've just said, which has now taken over a minute to say, is literally in a nanosecond of a, I hate the word bond, but a link, if you like, that you've created between them and you. And that's why, and that is why, you know, it's different. That's why it's, you, and so you, that's when you can get moments like that of real insight and real humanity in interviews, which, and this is not to criticize anybody because it's just the way of the world. If you are just random X interviewer, and you're suddenly thrust in with a microphone to a footballer who's missed a penalty in a shootout, and they have no idea who you are. They've never met you before. That's a very hard interview to do because you don't know. You just simply don't know where to. You, how far do you push that? Because they don't know you, and you, and also you don't know them. You know.
Yeah, I suppose it goes back to what you said at the beginning about making sure that that people have done the hard yards and done their apprenticeship, so to speak, so that when you do get those big moments, you've got.
There's an area. Well, see, when those moments happen, the player concerned, whoever they are, whatever they are, there's a vague recognition. They look at you and say, I can't remember what your name is, but I know you've been around the block a bit. I know you know how to do this. Okay, I'll talk to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, a bit like what we do. Hopefully people's, you know, we go to most people and they would never have heard of Josh or his podcast. Only very rarely have people have heard of it.
Yeah.
You have to try and win people's trust, I suppose, don't you, from the
get-go? Yes, absolutely.
So we'll talk quickly about Roland Garros.
Yeah.
You secured the role as anchor or presenter or ITV's coverage of that. Difficult question, but how would you sum up the differences between sports presentation on BBC and ITV?
I don't think there is any. Well, I think it depends on the individual, but I don't think there necessarily has to be. I mean, you're obviously constrained a bit by advertising breaks, which means you can't get into massively long conversations. You know, if you're doing a rugby match on BBC, you've got effectively 14 or 15 minutes at half time. So if there's an incident, if there's a controversial incident, you can say, well, we're going to give that 5 or 6 minutes and we're going to talk about it. We're going to talk, you know, we're going to talk the hind legs off it. And if somebody says something that you don't agree with, you can pick them up on it. You know, if somebody says, as far as I'm concerned, that was not a red card. It wasn't a red card. As the presenter, you can say, oh, come on. Of course it was a red card because of X, Y, and Z. You'll say, no, it wasn't. No, no, no. And suddenly you've got a conversation going that could last 90 seconds or whatever. On ITV, if you've got an ad break as you come out of the match and an ad break going back into the match, you've probably got 4 minutes. You can't have that conversation in depth. I will ask you, was it a red card? You'll say, no, it wasn't because of this. I haven't really got time to pick you up on that because we've got to do something else.
Yeah.
So what it does is it constrains, but through this, no fault of anybody. It's just the medium. It's just, who pays the bills? You know, you can talk on the BBC because the world is paying the bills through the licence fee for the moment. You know, on ITV, the adverts are what's funding the whole thing. Yeah. So, that's why you have to, if there are 5 talking points in a half of rugby, you probably narrow it down to 2, 2.5, because you haven't got time, physically, you haven't got time to discuss things at any great length. So it does minimise the debate. But that's true of all mediums when you have advertising blocks that can sometimes get in the way.
But I say
get in the way, you know, if you were talking to me and I'm the commercial person at ITV, he'd almost say that the sport gets in the way of the adverts. So it depends where you're coming at it from, you know?
So beyond competitive sport, I suppose, competitive sport. In 1998, you secured the role of presenter of World's Strongest Man.
Yes.
How involved were you in the dynamics of the show, and what did that teach you about the psychological limitations of the human body?
Oh, my Lord, the psychological limitations of the human body. Doing the show, it was entertainment. It was. I didn't regard it as, like most sport is sport, brackets plus entertainment. World's Strongest Man was entertainment, brackets plus sport. That was the fundamental thinking behind it, because of the time it went out, the audience demographic, you know, lots of kids watch it, everything like that. The one thing I would say, the one image I hold in my head, the one image for all the years that I did that, was at Valletta Airport in Malta, watching these guys pull a 747 down a runway. I just remember looking at that and going, oh my, how on earth, how do you get that thing going? It was just just startling. It really was. And they were all immensely nice guys, and I loved doing it. I absolutely loved doing it. We went to some fantastic places, which obviously helped, but they were all immensely nice, and irrespective of what nationality they were, how much English they could speak, they engaged in the program, and I think they made it a really entertaining watch as well.
Yeah. 2002, you presented a special edition of the 80s game show Superstars for the first ever sport relief. How competitive did the former athletes become?
Golly, that's 20 years ago. I've actually forgotten about it. I remember John Regis being utterly useless at canoeing. I think everybody was very competitive. I don't really remember it very well, to be honest. You obviously, Josh, have you watched it recently or something? Is it still there somewhere?
Well, the games has just been on again, hasn't it? On ITV, they brought the games back, didn't they? So,
we did it in Bath. That's about all I can remember of it. All I remember about it was doing it in Bath and the canoeing in the lee of the Abbey, and all of us wondering how long it would take before John Regis tipped upside down and was floating down the River Avon, heading towards the Severn Estuary and out into the Atlantic.
Yeah. Looking back at your career, what's your proudest achievement?
I don't know if any of it's an achievement, but all I would say is, because I was brought up, my dad's great passions were rugby, boxing, athletics. My mum's great passions were tennis, swimming. I was brought up in a way that I could not possibly have been not engaged in sport, if you know what I mean, or not appreciated the value of it or what it gives you outside of just competition, but in terms of friendship, in terms of lifestyle, in terms of whatever it might be. And so when I started doing what I was doing, the motivation all the while there, I mean, obviously, you want to have a good time and have fun, and, you know, it's barely a job. I mean, people often, you know, say that and you go, yeah, but actually it's not really a job. You know, you're finding yourself in a position of immense privilege to be at all these great events. And, you know, I don't think I ever lay awake at night worrying about the job. I'm worried about lots of other things, but the job, you know, you're just talking about sport. But the achievement, such as it is to get as many people as possible, either through radio or television, maybe more importantly, people who weren't sporty, who aren't instinctively, inherently sporty, to get them to think, this is good, I like sport, or I like this sport, or whatever it might be, to try and get people to think this part of society, which I don't by and large tend to engage in very much for whatever reason, but because of the way, you know, we as the messenger have brought this across, I'd quite like to go and see if I can go down to my local rowing club or whatever it might be. So to bring it to the widest possible people, and to make people who wouldn't normally be engaged and interested, to get them interested. And that often went down. I did the Cheltenham Festival on radio for 30 odd years. The number of people who said to me, we have no interest in horse racing, but we love listening to Cheltenham on the radio because you make us kind of understand why, if that's your world, it is your world, why you love it. And I just think that's the most important thing that we can do. It's no different. I in the same way that if you spoke to a DJ and he'd say, you know, Janice Long died recently. And Janice would always, I mean, her passion for music was huge, but she would always say, why is she doing it? She would say, because I've heard a new song by X. And by the means of me being on the radio, I can play that record to as many people as possible. And if 10% of them, the next time they're in the pub, say, have you heard that record by X? It's great. You really ought to listen to it. She's done her job. Mm-hmm. And that was always her great passion. And I would say that the same from our point of view, from people involved in, from my perspective, broadcasting sport. If anybody ever sat in the pub and said, did you hear? Whatever it was. It was really great. I've never really been interested in badminton before, but I really enjoy. I might find out a bit more about it. I've kind of always. It makes you sound a bit like a missionary, but I've always felt that from a sporting point of view.
Yeah.
Hmm. So, what's next for John Inverdell?
Well, I'm on the council of the rugby union. I'm on the board of Cheltenham Racecourse, so I've become a blazer. But I think the key thing when you're a blazer is still to keep that little slightly undercurrent of rebelliousness in there so that you keep poking the bear a bit. You don't just sit there and drink and eat the prawn sandwiches. You ask the question, why are these sandwiches made of prawn? Never stop doing that.
Yeah, great. Okay, well, that's... Trust me, you never thought you'd have John Inverdale talk about prawn sandwiches on his podcast, but there you go. And thanks very much. Thanks for
Your time. And listen, Josh, thank you so much for asking. And I hope at some point over the years, you know, we've given you some pleasure, radio or television wise, whatever the sport might be.
Definitely.
Thank you to our guest for being the subject of another Beyond the Title interview. If you liked this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything else that takes your fancy? Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews and to see more information about me and what I do. Thanks again, and hopefully see you next time.